Thanks for engineering this whole connection with Kern, Dr. Magnuson. I have done a lot of things. I've done them all badly, by the way. You know, you can do a lot of things if you have no standards. Just excellence gets in the way, you know, but you can cover a lot of ground. By the way, there are two of these. One is Legatees of a Great Inheritance, and one is Israel and Legitimacy, Modern Achievement, and Islamic Prejudice. So this comes from the Kairos Journal team. Let me say just a little bit of background about where I'm coming from with regard to Islam and Israel today, particularly. 48 years ago, I first went to Israel in 1967. I know you don't think I'm a day over 40, but just roll with me here. And back then, the Mount of Olives was in Jordan. And to go from one part of Jerusalem to another, you had to use a passport as you went through the Mandelbaum Gate. And so when you're up in the Jezreel Valley, you have bunkers by the kibbutzim because you have artillery from the Syrian Heights, the Golan Heights, shelling. It was a very different world. The next summer, they had the Six-Day War, where they took the West Bank and Golan and Gaza and Sinai. So there's that background. And since then, I've been there, I think, seven times now. Most recently, Dr. Wills and Dr. Schreiner, and we had a tour there and in Jordan. And I was a guest of the Israeli Defense Forces on my sixth trip, where we went to listening posts on Golan and looked down into Syria and went to the drone base in Gaza and so forth. So a lot of time in Israel. One of the wonderful things about being a Southern Baptist is you take a lot of mission trips. And so I've been to Khartoum twice, biked up the Nile from Luxor to Aswan with nights in Isna, Kamombo, and Idfu, witnessing as we go up there. With Kairos Journal, we've worked with people who have been run out of Pakistan because they're Christians and they settled in Australia and been persecuted for vilifying Islam in a church talk. We've worked with Peter Akinola, the Archbishop of Nigeria, who brought me 18 hours of videotape on PAL format, and we put them into a 15-minute video about all the persecution in northern Nigeria, Boko Haram in Jos and Kano and Idfu and Kaduna. I might or might not have a son who is on the mission field somewhere, I'm not supposed to say, somewhere around Southeast Asia, and been out there to see him four times where there are a lot of Muslims. And so it's one thing after another, climbed Mount Sinai and snuck around the back streets of Khartoum. And so I haven't been a full-time missionary and I haven't been an Arabic scholar, but been around. You know, I stayed in the Holiday Inn Express last night, and so I'll do my best. We're going to have to think fast and talk fast, but I've got about 25 little PowerPoint slides, and I've got some video to watch at first. But let me just introduce this first thing and say that when I was there with the IDF folks, we were coming up from Galilee up to the Golan, all the way up to the top of Mount Hermon. And our guide, he was actually a general from the Israeli army, pointed back down the valley as we were climbing. We were going around towards Caesarea Philippi. And as we looked down in the valley, he said, by the way, this was a malarial swamp under the Ottomans for hundreds and hundreds of years. And you've heard of the marsh Arabs down at the bottom. And you remember in Iraq and how Saddam mistreated those guys at the confluence of the, you know, the Euphrates and Tigris, and how, and they just kind of worked these little pole boats in and around and lived in the marsh, and he was nervous about them, so he drained the swamps and so forth. Well, they had marsh Arabs, marsh Bedouin, up north of Galilee. You know, the snows of Mount Hermon melt, and they run down through some wonderful streams, but then it just kind of settled. There was a big basalt hump down at the end of the valley and a bridge whose columns were too close together, and it just jammed it up. And it turns out that it's about 20 square miles. It turned out that no one could really go in there except the residents. They wove mats to sell, but you got black fever, swamp fever, yellow fever, what have you. The Israelis, after 948, took it over, and they drained the swamp. And they turned it into something of the breadbasket of Israel. Had a lot of papyrus. They actually drained it too well, and you had all this peat that had been built up through the years, and once the oxygen hit it, every once in a while, like a spark would light it, and it would just burn and burn and burn. So they had to, like, raise the water level in places to keep the thing from burning up. And then the environmentalists went crazy and they said all the migratory birds used to love to stop there. Instead of flying across the Mediterranean, they would work from Europe down into Africa there. And so they got a national park in the southern part of the Hula Valley, like hula hoop, okay, or sometimes H-U-L-E-H. And so they have a park down there now, and it's a beautiful place, and they have wetlands and migratory birds and observation points and water buffalo and so forth. So everybody's happy there, and it's just an example of how Israeli ingenuity just jumps in and says, hey. And by the way, I think it was like 9 billion gallons of water evaporated every year from that. It just sat there, couldn't get out, and it just evaporated. Now they just sluice out of there, and they're able to, you know, irrigate all kinds of stuff. So we're going to look at a little footage. I did an aesthetics course for the online department, and they gave me a camera and said, wherever you go, shoot stuff. So I shot aesthetics, but I also shot some of this. By the way, a quick ad. This is going to be kind of snarky toward Islam, okay? But I want to tell you, it's not a triumphalistic thing. It's a heartbroken thing. And I've done a fair amount of evangelism with Muslims. Had lunch with a Kurd a couple of days ago that is a friend I'm working with in Nashville. And a little ad, we're taking the Detroit mission trip on spring break, the Bevan Center. And each time we go up there, we go to mosque. We were with Shiites last time. I was with Sunnis with a NAM thing. So if you have an interest in American Muslims and reaching out to them, my wife will be in the lobby here and she'll be signing. No, that's not true. The Bevan Center will sign you up. Let's run the video. It's about 4 minutes of video. And I'm just going to talk you through. I guess I need to get down here. Is this going to mess up the sound system? If you look up here, this is very amateurish, but I'm driving along the Hula Valley here. We're driving in the Hula Valley. And you can just see, this is not a malarial swamp. This is all, that is not the right place to go. So anyway, it's just all kind, you have all kinds of orchards and crops and so forth and so on. And they have just transformed it into a food source. It's, you know, you can see the Golan in the distance. I mean, it is pretty stark and dry. But down in this lowland, just any number of things. They have flowers and they have bananas. And Sharon helped me, my child bride, Sharon here of 40-something years. What else did we see growing down there in the Hula?
Eucalyptus.
Eucalyptus, yeah. Oh, here we go. Here we go. This is the very highest quality video. It's a handheld thing shot by moi. But as you're getting a little, it will get a little bit higher, and you can look down and hear just row after row after row after row of stuff. And I'm thankful. I didn't mean to sound snotty about the environmental movement. I'm glad that you've got that kind of balance, and these guys pled for it. As you get down into the Hula Valley, they have a kind of a video center, and you sit in there. And it's like all sense around. They have chairs that jerk around, and then they have guys flying, I guess, with ultralights in the middle of geese or something. And so when they move, you're going like that. You're in the goose thing, and then like they'll go through a crowd and they'll spritz water in your face. And so I've flown to the Hula Valley or through the Hula Valley. Now we're in the national park, and we're walking across this bridge over toward. I do not have a steady cam, by the way. This is it. But as we head up the sidewalk, you just see, you know, a lot of vegetation. I think those are eucalyptus trees up to the left here. Don't tell Spielberg that I have a camera. He'll enlist me. You see in the distance the dry hills. Those are over on the western side. And as we go up this valley, then you see and it's just, you know, nasty water and just this what you'd get from a wetland. I mean, that's just like catnip to migratory birds, or maybe migratory cats, I'm not sure. As you look in the distance, there's a water buffalo. They have some of the original guys there. And then this is a bridge people use for observation. That was weird. I don't know what that part was, but you could see Golan in the distance. But here I'm walking through a narrow bridge to the rushes. This is the way it used to be before you could grow everything under under the sun. And then we come across a bunch of catfish here. And I think I was inebriated that day or something like that, but those were fish swirling around. And then as you get on this bridge, you have these people observing wildlife, and on the walls you have the key to what kind of bird looks like what, and you just sit. Now, then you go farther south, and we're out of the wildlife area. This is the Dead Sea Works, okay? They have discovered potash in the southern part of the Dead Sea. A Russian engineer found this back in the, like around 1800. And ever since, a lot of people have invested in this, and they've almost, by evaporation beds, almost pumped the bottom of the Dead Sea dry. If you look in your old Bible maps, you know, you believe the Bible from Genesis to maps. If you go back to maps, you'll see that lisan, that tongue that sticks out into the Dead Sea. And it's almost, the bottom half is almost dirt now because they've done, they have Filipino and Thai guys coming in, and this is the Ottawa. This is the Jordan Valley Rift that goes all down, you know, the lowest part on Earth. This is like lower than Death Valley. And it's just been, it's on the edge of the Negev. It is just desolate. And now there are hundreds of farms and kibbutzes, and they have these kind of plastic things they put over the crops. And this is a kibbutz where we stayed. And they bring these guys in from all over creation. They have all this irrigation stuff. In other words, the Israelis have taken this desert that's been desert for millennia, and they're making the desert bloom. And I would argue that this comes from a Judeo-Christian heritage, unlike an Islamic tradition or heritage, if that makes sense to you. Could we maybe, just for my peace of mind, lower that and can we project something right? It's not working. Okay, all right. As they say, the devil is in the always in the PA system or something like that, or AV system. I'm going to race through some slides and try to say why I think it's a different thing. Now, we talk about all kinds of dangerous, crazy things done by Muslim extremists and Islamic extremists, and we'll touch on that a little bit. But it's rather the normal Islamic nature of the countries that I'm going to talk about today, that the center of mass of Islam is not conducive to human flourishing. The Judeo tradition, and you'll find this, and by the way, there are these two books where we spell all this out. The Judeo-Christian tradition is actually salubrious. It contributes to human well-being. And so I hope by these, I can go back down and do that. I hope by these slides to kind of make the point here. So let's track through them. I don't have a fancy thing like, or maybe I should just do that and say next. Okay, next. This one is a little more complicated, but bear with me here. On the left is a classic picture of the Christian God. He's kind of like the geometer of the world, and he's the guy who he is the Lord who has designed a very orderly and wonderful and law-like world, and on that basis. And by the way, he's benevolent. On that basis, then we can have natural science. We can have confidence in testing and so forth. Alfred North Whitehead, who was no Christian at all, basically said that modern science depends upon a Christian or Judeo-Christian base. I mean, part of it is the God is not impetuous. He's not like angry, like the gods are angry, and that's why we have thunder. And he may be angry today and not angry tomorrow. By the way, he's benevolent. So in sciences, in doing the sciences, we're almost like running downstairs on Christmas morning, wondering what presents we're going to open. Like, oh, here's a new tree. Let's take the sap and run it through a lab or something. Whoa, it cures something, you know. So we're just constantly excited about what we'll find. The Muslims are more leery about that. I mean, I know that there have been Muslim scientists, and I know that whether it's like the overflow of the Nile, they trust that and work with this and that. But there is a big body of thought in Islam that suggests that when we talk about laws of nature, then that's like a threat to God. You know, it's impinging upon his goodness. And the same thing goes with morality. The natural law tradition says that it basically is kind of sweetly reasonable. You know, you don't break the Ten Commandments, you break yourself on the Ten Commandments because they are life-giving. But an Islamic approach is more of God just kind of fires from heaven and says, do this, and you think, well, I don't know why. What do you mean, why? You don't ask why, you know? I was looking through, this is the chief guidebook to life in Southeast Asia for Muslims called The Reliance of the Traveler. And every time I read this, I just, it's like, it's offensive to pray in the presence of food or drink one would like to have, unless one fears that the prayer's time will end. It's offensive to interlace your fingers when praying. And he's never been to prayer meeting at a Baptist church. We have potluck. But if I'm looking at that chicken and we're saying prayer, well, we've offended or something like that. It's offensive to speak while lovemaking or when in the laboratory or relieving ones. I mean, they just got everything. If you're going to bet on a race, if a camel races a burro, then, you know, whatever. Or if you and this gal had the same wet nurse, then if you marry, it's incest. And it's like, what? 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 But see, that's kind of beside the point, because Allah has spoken. There's an authority, and they don't. It's a fiat ethic, in a sense. And there is, in our tradition, more of a natural law feeling, whether you're Thomas Aquinas or Carl Henry, that the instructions of God and the deliverances of science are just sweetly reasonable and perfectly reasonable. And it kind of puts a jam on them in a little bit in developing and thoughtful ethics and so forth. Click, okay. We're driven by the creation mandate, Genesis 1:28, be fruitful, multiply, exercise dominion, you know, subdue the earth. And God says, have at it. That's a picture by Thomas Hart Benton of harvest. And they have harvesting there too. But there's a greater sense of fate. And there's not that same sense I guess you could say, holy ambition and industry to get. And so you have this kind of silly thing, Nike Arabia, just do it tomorrow, you know, inshallah, if God wills. It's just a more laid-back kind of thing. And as I talk to missionaries who work there, they kind of adjust. When they get over there, they're all wired and like, we're going to meet at 8:30 and we're going to do this and that. And then you kind of, either you have a nervous breakdown or you relax. And you kind of, you learn a little inshallah and so forth. So that changes the culture and human flourishing. Next. The state of women. Huge thing. Huge problem. You've got the kind of the traditional wedding, one with one, over here, and then you've got I couldn't resist the guy from Malaysia over here in the lower right-hand corner, this big old rascal with his happy gals giving him food. But polygamy is a big problem in Islam. By the way, in the lower left-hand corner, we have women scientists at the Weizmann Institute, and that thing, if it went a little farther, you'd see an Israeli woman soldier who's delivering life-saving materials to a Palestinian who's been wounded. There's a lady named Noni Darwish who came to a conference we had in Vienna. Kairos Journal sponsored a conference. It was a secret conference with about 100 people. We met in a castle above Vienna, and they brought in heads of state and Jewish and Catholic and secular people. We had people from the Polish parliament, the Italian parliament. We had Melanie, what's her name, the Jewish writer for one of the, Melanie Phillips, who writes for one of the London papers, and she wrote a book called Londonistan. She was there. Archbishop Akinola from Nigeria was there, and just all kinds of interesting, former president of Spain, Aznar. And we talked about just all kinds of difficulties that Europe is being essentially overtaken in many cases by Muslims. I mean, the British city of Bradford, banlieue in Paris, and we're saying to them, you can't stop Islam with secularism for a variety of reasons. And by the way, you don't get Europe out of secularism. You get Europe out of a Judeo-Christian base. And one of the ladies there was named Noni Darwish. She was the daughter of a intelligence officer for Egypt, and they were running raids out of Gaza into Israel before 1967. And they tried to take him out, Israeli commandos did. They came to her house, and Dad wasn't home, and they left everybody alive, untouched. Dad's not home, we go back. And they later got her dad, and they came back to Egypt as kind of heroes, family of the martyr. And so that sounded great. The government put them up with a stipend and the like. But then she discovered her mother, who was a widow, couldn't have married friends. Because if she goes and visits a married friend and the husband comes home, then he might say, whoa, that's pretty good for wife number two or three. And so they're very skittish about that. And married women can't have single friends who've never been married, so it's very hard. All that intrigue you see in the Old Testament about where you have temple light, that's just replicated. Will my son be the favorite son? Will your son be? And so you get to these little rivalries. And read a book called The Bookseller of Kabul about a guy who's a bookseller, and he finds a younger woman, takes a shine to her, sends his old wife, the wife of his youth, back to Pakistan to run the depot while he runs the retail in Kabul, and just the heartache that comes with that sort of thing. It's a terrible thing what's happened to women. The women's testimony under Sharia law is half that of a man. If you want to get a rape conviction in Pakistan under the Hadush laws, you have to have 4 male witnesses to the rape. And if you fail to sustain the charge, you may be charged with adultery or promiscuity or whatever, because you've admitted to having sex with a guy, but you didn't make your case, and you're in trouble. Some Arab nations are better than others, some not so much. Polygamy is illegal in Egypt, but it's done anyway, kind of like the back streets of Utah. It's done, and the treatment of women is not, it's not great. The Judeo-Christian approach is much healthier. Next, please. I put this fear factor in here. I mean, I think that Muslims like to be fierce. ISIS likes to be fierce, and, you know, we're strong and confident and the like. But to me, it's one of the most cowardly religions I can imagine. I mean, they're terrified that they're going to see a woman's ankle or that some guy will preach the gospel freely. And so they keep a lid on everything. I mean, you just say, can you really not handle it? I mean, are you afraid that if we turn evangelism loose in Egypt and Jordan and so forth, then it's all over? And I think it would be, chances are, all over, because they keep the lid on. And look, I agree with Mary Moeller's book on modesty, and there's a lot to be said for modesty, but, you know, we can kind of handle it, honestly, if women don't wear long sleeves. Now, I do show some Orthodox guys here who say, please don't come through our neighborhood without wearing long sleeves and a long skirt. And sometimes these Orthodox guys get a little crazy, and, you know, I think they harass this 8-year-old girl for dressing immodestly, and I think that says more about them than the 8-year-old girl. But they have that, but it's marginal, and it's kept suppressed in Israel. But there is an enormous problem for women with regard to their dress in the renewal of, I mean, you know, just all kinds of movements in the Arab world. I also have a thing about evangelism. It is tricky in Israel to be openly evangelistic. They're very twitchy about demographics and whether, you know, they get a Jewish critical mass to hold their democracy in a Jewish place. But here's a Christian evangelist witnessing to some Israeli troops on the Golan Heights. On the other hand, you don't have outsiders evangelizing. You just have Coptics who just want to live in Egypt. And so you have Coptics under fire. Why are you so afraid of Christianity? You know, what is it about it? If it gets loose, then the game's up. We, on the other hand, and in Israel, it's like, go ahead, you know, put your religion out there, write a book, follow Allah, sacrifice cats, you know, go out and howl at the moon, whatever. Take your best shot. And there is a confidence, we do that, there's a confidence in saying, we can handle that, we can handle that. The Islamic world is terrified. I mean, all right, click. Constitutional democracy. It's the only democracy in the area, so we have kinship with Israel. You have Assad, and that's Sisi in his last name, in Egypt in the middle. He was a general. He took over. He's much better than the Muslim Brotherhood. But, you know, I really like Abdullah in Jordan. He's got a lot of gear on. I can't imagine he's been in that much battle, but at any rate, a lot of gear. And but he's a king, you know. And then you've got a pretty good guy who came out of the military down there in up there in Lebanon. And then you've got Israeli politics, which is a zoo, you know. It's just every kind of party and the like. And that's what we do. It was a zoo yesterday. It's a zoo in Israel. And we embrace the zoo. And that free marketplace of ideas where you can defame each other and brag on your stuff and fly this flag and fly that flag, that is awfully important for human flourishing and development. Otherwise, you become insular, broken. It's a free market thing, in a sense. And it's just so controlled in these other places. Next. We hear about the Muslim street. Look, there's a street everywhere. There's Occupy Wall Street, and there are Tea Partiers, and there are, you know, what have you. The quality of the street's a bit different. And here you have a couple of pictures. One is of a woman and a young man celebrating on 911 as the towers were burning and falling. I submit to you that if, like, the big tower in, Dubai falls, you're not going to have people in the Israeli street dancing around like that. Or if a house collapses in Palestine, you're not going to have dancing and, you know, what have you. And then it seems like the Arab street really does like to have guns. You know, this is a Palestinian thing. AK-47s show up regularly, and you have firing there. I had a prophet, Vanderbilt, who once talked about a fellow. He said he has no epistemology. That's an odd way to put it. But he says there's no filter. There are no standards for rationality or something. It's just anything goes. There's no hard question about what counts and what doesn't count or what's reasonable. There's a shortage of epistemology in the Arab street. Like, oh yeah, Jews did 9-1-1 so that we'd react again. Or hey, or in Nigeria, polio vaccine, that's some imam will say, that's a Western tradition or Western attempt to kill our people or something, give them all polio. And and the next thing you know, they're killing vaccine guys, you know. It's just kind of whack. Now, there is an Israeli protest there. During the Gaza incursion, some of the Israelis said, hey, let's not do that. And they hold up signs, but you got these old guys, middle-aged guys, just kind of leaning on the barricade, like, hey, we got a sign back there, read it. There's a different quality of the populace, and I think it has a lot to do with the fact that fewer than 50% of the women are literate in Egypt, that they're just not as well-read, and there are just a variety of things that contribute to it. But the Israeli street's a lot more like our street and Western streets, okay? The Sheikh's Dilemma. There's a wonderful book called Startup Nation and by Dan Senor, and he talks about various things in Israel that are entrepreneurial and quite exciting. I mean, he talks about things with electric cars in the Hula Valley and so forth. And he says, you'll have the Sheikh's Dilemma. The Sheikh is the ruler in these areas. And he wants his nation to progress and to, you know, have a great airline and look cool outside and be respectable and so forth. But he doesn't want a dissent, and he doesn't want a whole bunch of people getting, like, too educated and too smart and too uppity and so forth, or too powerful, because then he's threatened. It's a power-based sort of thing. And so you have Assad and the Saudi prince there. But then you look to the right, and this appeared in Haaretz, which is the leading sort of left-to-center Israeli newspaper, which means the earth. All right? Bereshith bara Elohim et hashamayim ve et haaretz. And God created the heavens and the earth. You all know that, Hebrew guys. That's Bibi Netanyahu in the cockpit flying into the World Trade Center. And the cartoon said, Netanyahu, you're doing more damage to our relationship with America than, you know, you're making an enemy of America more than the real 9-1 flyers made an enemy of themselves with America. Well, that's a snotty thing. But you know what? They can do that. And they could do a Muhammad cartoon, and they could do any kind of cartoon in Israel. And there is that sense of, you ain't my sheikh, you know? I mean, we're just a bunch of guys who can say what we jolly well please, and as messy as it is, as awkward as it is absolutely essential for, I would say, cultural health and growth. And by the way, I think that's one reason the Southern Baptist Convention has had a resurgence, that we just didn't turn the whole thing over to an episcopate or, you know, some really grand guys at some really small group that meets once a year. It's the gong show. I mean, you know, when we had 55,000 people there, in Dallas, and people driving up from Little Hope Baptist Church in Bodcaw, Arkansas or something, and they've got as many votes as First Dallas, and you can take that mic and say, I don't like what you're wearing, you know. Messy. But boy, let the people do their thing. Let them talk. And by the way, I would say at the local congregation too, but that's another whole thing. All right, so what's next here? I can look here. Oh, just a look. That's not entirely fair, but it's the only picture I could find. Pre-1948, Hula Valley, Marsh Arabs, Marsh Bedouins, great people. None of this, by the way, is meant to reflect on Arabs or whatever. They're God's creation, loved equally with us, ingenious, wonderful people. This is about Islam. And it's like this blanket that's fallen on people and produced squalor. I mean, there are quotes all over the place. I think it's like the manufactured export of the entire Muslim world from like Mauritania to Bangladesh is less than that of Finland alone. They had Nokia phones or something like that. Now, they a lot of oil, but that's we're talking about manufactured stuff. It's like the reverse Midas touch. When Islam comes in, it produces squalor. Now, there are a lot of wonderful, kind, hospitable Muslims, but in terms of flourishing of society, it's the reverse Midas touch. It is really sad. And then you see the Israelis with their 1940s gear digging up papyrus, you know, trying to make that farmland. Okay, what's next? Free press, kind of talked about that. Netanyahu's about to speak. He's just walking into the lion's den. You know, on the other hand, you have Jordanians who have tape over their mouth. And Jordan's a wonderful place as far as that kind of culture goes. But boy, they limit their press, and so they're saying, this is not fair, what you've done. As much as I hate a lot of stuff that's in the press, I mean, you know, just give me a New York Times with Paul Krugman and what's the redheaded gal's name? The columnist. Marine Dowd and others, and you just, you know, and then I turn on and there's, you know, what have you, Rachel Maddow or something, and I just say, oh, Lord, you know. But thank God we've got a place where you can do that, but you can also do a limbo and so forth and so on. It's just, it's messy, but it's necessary for flourishing. Okay, what do we got here? Yeah, so this guy came over from America, a Jewish fella, and when he was over there, he invented a desalinization process. And they had these big desalinization plants on the shores of Israel, and he decided to stay, and it was some kind of very fancy thing. It's like a reverse osmosis, nano, you know, ferret something, I don't know, and it was fancy. And he stayed, and so they produced that. Well, you don't have that being produced in Jordan or Egypt and so forth. Now, Jordan does have a little desalinization out of the Dead Sea, but it's not with their technology. If you go into the Arnon River Valley on the east side, kind of over near Sodom, and so it's in Moab, you will see a dam now. And you can see the water, the reservoir down below. And it's really a beautiful place. It's in a really desolate place east of the Dead Sea. It used a rolled concrete technology, which was developed in northern Italy and perfected in northern Canada. And then you go there. Well, they're smart to pick up on it. But you don't develop technologies in these areas. You pick up on them. And I'm glad they do. And I'm glad the dam's there, and they use that for irrigation, and they need it desperately. But I thank God that I live in a tradition that actually comes up with technologies, you know. And you don't get saved by technology, you know. It's not that you stand before Christ and he says, what have you got? And, well, I'm from a place that has desalinization plants, you know. Good enough. Come on in. No, there's no means of salvation here, and it's not a guarantee of virtue, but it's good stuff. What else we got here? This is a little snarky too, but we had a Muslim comedian come to Chicago, and he said the only thing Muslims export is ouds and olive oil. That was one of his lines. Well, ouds are these little things like that, and olive oil is that. Now, that's not quite true, but Israelis, through the Weizmann Institute, they work on childhood diseases. That's a computer that involves photonic something with quantum computer. I don't know what this is here. I have a diesel computer, and I just it works, but the fumes are terrible. The guy in the lower picture is in some sort of experiment there, and it's at the Weizmann Institute. It has to do with MRI or magnetic resonance stuff. So they're doing cutting-edge science that then they give to the world. Not so much. I like ouds, but all right. Next. This looks pretty ominous. One of the things we got to do when we went to the IDF is that we saw the commissioning of the paratroopers at the Wailing Wall to the Western Wall, like at 10 at night. Very solemn thing. And as they step forward, they give them their rifles, and then their shirts are unbuttoned, and they slip a Tanakh, the Hebrew Old Testament, in their shirts. Now, there are a lot of secular Israelis, and they're not like, wait, we're supposed to take that hill. Let's get out, you know, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, don't cut down fruit trees or something, you know, but there is a general ethos to a place that rests on the Tanakh as opposed to the Quran. And this is a fighter on the other side. Next. One of the things they teach the Israeli army is purity of arms. If your nation is terrorist, if they're giving cash prizes to mothers who have given their children to blow someone up on a bus in Tel Aviv, you have a morally impoverished nation. You can't flourish with that kind of thing. And here you have two, well, I saw this, I couldn't resist the thing at the bottom here. But here's an Israeli soldier protecting a baby carriage. Here is a Palestinian soldier hiding behind a baby carriage. There is more truth to that. That is not just a joke. I mean, they will put their stuff in places we don't want to shoot. On the far side there is a Hamas leader's car who was hit by a rocket from a drone. On the other side is a Hamas driver who is driving into a train stop, a light rail train stop in Jerusalem, killing a child. It was the firstborn son they'd been waiting for a long time, killed a baby. And as sometimes I say, these folks can blow up a car. They just can't build one. I mean, there's no Islamic car, you know. Now, there are Muslims who work on the assembly line in Detroit, and I'm not saying they're unable to turn a screw, but in terms of everything that goes in, Francis Schaeffer's made this point, everything that goes into science and technology, the rule of law, an educational base, you know, just technological learning and all this kind of stuff, even a good work ethic, it's hard to get it together in a Muslim country. Now, I'm going to make champions of Islam out of all of you. I'm being so offensive, but just bear with me here. Let's press on. There is an honor and shame culture instead of a guilt and blame culture. When I was in Jordan, in Amman, I think for the second time, the Queen of Jordan's campaign, Barbara Bush. Huh? No, that was Nancy Reagan, drugs, just say no. Barbara Bush was literacy, Michelle Obama is good food or whatever, Lady Bird Johnson was highway beautification. You know, they each have a project. Hers was, stop the honor killing of your family members. Because the jails of Amman, this isn't Saudi Arabia, the jails of Amman, or some people say Amman, were filling up with terrified sisters and nieces and daughters of people who might have looked wrong at a infidel or, you know, ridden on the back of a motorcycle or something, and they have to protect them from being killed. So you have the case of the uppity girl who got her nose cut off, and then you have this cab ad. If you sense an honor killing coming, call this number. In our culture, I don't care if it's embarrassing to your family. The question is she guilty of a capital crime? This family, I get McLean's magazine, it's a Canadian magazine, and there was about an 8-page article about this family. The daughters were uppity, and they were flirting with non-Muslims, and so the son, who's at the top, took them out in a car, and they didn't know what was coming. It was a Mercedes, I think, and with the encouragement of the mother and the dad, drove it off into a canal, jumped out at the last minute, killed his three sisters. That may work, and pardon me, that may work in a part of the world. That doesn't work in Canada. We work with a different system, and it's not enough that it was an affront to your family's dignity or your religion that you can kill somebody. In Jordan, maybe it's a problem. Whatever, not here, you know. Don't come here. All right, what else we got? Refuge for Jews. I talk a little bit in one of the booklets, or we talk about the whole thing, the Palestinian issue, and whether the land thing is this and that. One of the things Israel says is we are the only place on earth where a Jew can come. If you're 1/4 Jew, one grandparent, the same principle Hitler used to kill people, then you can come to our place. And so they have come from all over the place. In many cases, they've left their property. It was confiscated. They come in. And the movie, The Voyage of the Damned, was about a ship in 1937 came to America and said, bad things are happening in Europe. Can we stay here? We turned them away. They went back to Europe. Over 200 of them died in the death camps. This is a place of refuge for the Jews. And it's a democracy. So if you have like a whole different demographic and you've got a bunch of people coming in and all of a sudden you're not in the majority, then it becomes Egypt or something. You know, it's all over. So they are very protective of their, and they bring them from Ethiopia and Russia and the like. And if you have issues about the Palestinian, we write about that. I can't go into all that right now. But by the time of national independence, they had bought 30% of the land, just bought it from Ottomans. In fact, Jaffa was a neat town on the coast, and they said, well, I don't know, could we have maybe some of that swampy land down on the seashore? And they said, okay, some old Ottoman sold it to them, and it's Tel Aviv today. You know, they just do that sort of thing, all right? We're almost done. Racial equality, there are Muslims in the Israeli parliament. Here are two Muslims in the Knesset. I wasn't really nice in picking the other picture. These are Islamists in the Egyptian parliament. They're not looking too inspiring. But you could probably go to the Kentucky legislature and get a similar shot. I don't know, or certainly in Tennessee. But at any rate, there are no Jews in the Egyptian parliament. If you forget that. But the Israelis say, look, if you got the votes, come on. And they have served as ambassadors and Supreme Court judges and so forth. And there are actually Muslims in the Israeli army who are snipers and trackers and stuff like that. What else we got here? Very simple thing. Property is a real tough thing to come by in Egypt, real estate. Not so much in Israel. So I've got the Century 21 Israel sign. I went working through Google Image to find an Egyptian real estate company, and I found one, but it's actually Southern Illinois. It's called Lower Southern, you know, like the Seleucus, that's the dog for SIU because it's an Egyptian dog. But it's hard to own property. If you don't own private property, it's very tough to get a quality of life thing going. And Egypt is very short on that, almost done here. Universities are the 400 top universities in the world. There are several listings of these. There are four of them in Israel. You know, Tel Aviv U, Hebrew U, Ben-Gurion University of the Negev, and then Israel Tech, so to speak, Technical Institute. There is none in the surrounding countries around Israel. The only thing that comes close is the American University in Beirut and the American University in Cairo. But it, now you see that fancy building on the side. What happened is in Qatar, I think it is, or the UAE somewhere, they built this big building and they invite American universities to come over. So Northwestern, Michigan State, there they put a lot of security around them, but they import Western, University of Exeter in England. That's kind of how they have to do it because they don't have a tradition of free thought. And by the way, if your women can't do it and your infidels can't do it, you're really limited. I mean, you cut out the Madame Curies and the Amelia Earharts and you know, Christian Bernard, who did the first heart transplant, he was a philanderer, you know, and yet we'll think, well, yeah, but if he learned something, you know, let's learn how to do heart transplants. And I know Hitler got behind the Volkswagen, but I'm going to buy one, you know. It's just like you get your good ideas where you can. But if you shut off all the people who disagree with you, then you're going to be, you know, retarded as a culture. What else have we got here? Real quick thing. I was going to read. I did a thing in this book I did on moral apologetics about a huge embarrassment that came on the Arab countries. You had an Australian paper publish a list of the countries that came to Haiti after the earthquake in the first 10 days, 2 weeks. And there was no Muslim country on it. I mean, it was Israel. Everybody was sending something. French were sending sniffing dogs to go through rubble, and we were sending in pallets in C-17s, and others were doing tents and all this stuff. And with all the money they had, there was none. So they got embarrassed, and like they looked around on the couch, I think, in Saudi Arabia and found $1 million and sent it in, and somebody, I mean, they finally got hustled up. They do not have a compassionate tradition. Americans are crazy with that. You know, somebody, Franklin Graham's over there with a Navy or something, and next thing you know, it's Banda Aceh, it's this and that. We founded the Red Cross, essentially, Henry Dunant in Switzerland. There is a Red Magen, you know, the Red Star of David, like Mogan David wine, Mogan Star of David, not drinking Mogan David wine, I'm just saying. And then you've got the Red Crescent, but these are after type thing. And these are both in Haiti. They finally got over there. The Israelis got there early. Red Crescent comes in, but it's a huge problem. There is not a large heart toward the world, the same that you see with America, I mean with the Western world. And symphony, very quickly, I'll talk real fast. There's a Cairo symphony. God bless these guys, you know? And look what they're playing. I mean, they're playing Mahler and Rachmaninoff and Sibelius and so forth. There's an Israel symphony. But you think, well, that's nice. I mean, symphonic stuff, that's Western stuff. So maybe the Israeli symphony could play all the Egyptian symphonic. No, there's not. There's the one they played. Somebody had an Opus 1, and it was like an oud with a symphony. And I mean, every once in a while. But you think, well, yeah, but that's Western art. Well, then let's do all the other art. The arts, very short word, the arts are not flourishing there in painting. And so they don't have church music, you know? You'll go down Devon Avenue in Chicago, and There will be a Jewish shop there, Judaica, and you'll have little Northwestern University yarmulkes and little shofars and Seder plates, and then you'll have a klezmer band and some cantor chants and so forth. You get down to the Muslim shop, and you know there's like Cat Stevens, who became Yusuf something or other, and then there's a boy band from Malaysia, I think, and a fatwa's on them somewhere, and they're running around, and it's like this. You go to a Christian shop, you can hardly find a book anymore. It's just music, you know, and I mean, now MP3's changed that. We're the singing culture. We sing about a lot of stuff. And so, and not only the music, but just the instruments. I mean, you just think about it. Double reeds, bassoon, oboe, brass, you know, trumpet, trombone, cornet, French horn, and on and on and on, and stringed instruments, and viola, and all that richness, that comes out of the West, out of a Judeo-Christian tradition, which loves ingenuity and loves music. And there are all kinds of instruments that didn't even make the cut. Crumb horn, sack butt, recorder. They're not, I mean, that's really a thing. I'm not trying to be naughty here. What else we got here? Comedy, almost done. I keep saying that. After 9/11, there was this documentary about the Muslims are coming. We do comedy too. And there's one joke the lady said, yeah, she was in a bar and she was drunk and she saw an Israeli guy that looked kind of good and she didn't know about going home with him to have sex. And so she says, WWARCOD, what would Arafat and Rabin do circa the 1923 Oslo Accords? Bang, that's the joke. But that was about the funniest thing I heard. But I'm thinking, you tell that joke in Tehran, you're toast, you know? They don't laugh at themselves so much. They can't afford to laugh at themselves or each other so much. It's very, very dangerous. Among Jews, I mean, where do you go? I mean, what is that? Is that Sandler, Franken, Seinfeld? I think that's Peter Guest down there. You got Jon Stewart and Stiller and Jack Black and, you know, what's her name? Just died, Joan Rivers. And you got Sarah Silverman. It just goes on and on and on. That tradition of laughing at yourself is something we shouldn't take for granted. And laughing at others, you know, that sort of thing. It's, again, part of the freedom. Is that the last slide? Good. I'm sorry. I talked too long. But I just, in terms of the sciences and just laughing and orchestras and irrigation, and I mean, it's just, and it's not because Jews are, by virtue of being Jewish, going to heaven or something like that. It's that the biblical base, that God, all men are made in God's image. Be fruitful and multiply, subdue the earth, and so forth. Just the wisdom of the thing. A man who is meditates on the word of God, he's like a tree planted by rivers of water. He flourishes. And then you read the Quran and you read Reliance of the Traveler and you think, how in the world can you get life out of this? So missionary work to Muslims is to increase the Muslim population of heaven, for sure. But it's also an act of mercy to bring to them a worldview that will bring life to their country. Questions? I'm sorry. I said I'd stop at 12:30 and just felt a sermon coming on. And had a,
we have time for a couple questions.
Yeah. Yep.
So with the Muslim advance of Aristotelian philosophy, how do they view that?
It's really, that's very interesting, because if you look at, you know, they talk about the golden age of Islam, and we read guys like Averroes and Avicenna or Ibn Rushd, different names. And by the way, President Obama talked about this sort of thing actually in the Kairos talk, you remember, he made early on. And there was a time when they were piggybacking on Western culture in many respects, and they appreciated Aristotle, and he had a kind of common sense approach. And there's some somewhat sensible things that were said in the early days. They also made great stone inlaid dagger hilts, and they do great calligraphy and arabesque and steel for surgical instruments, and they borrowed stuff from India and numbers, and so we have algebra and algorithm and so forth. But it was kind of like a cut flower thing. They were relying upon others. You'd conquer a people, and then you'd appropriate their stuff. It's a little bit like Christians saying, Christianity's so smart. I mean, look at Ben Franklin. He was in a Christian nation, and he did the lightning rod or something. Yeah, but he wasn't a believer, but he was in the deal. So, yeah, there's some sensible, useful things said. I mean, we were just reading in philosophy of religion the other night, a little bit of, I think it was Avicenna, no, it was Averroes, and he was talking about differences in interpretation and kind of a natural law thing. But under the pressure of all this other stuff, it just kind of fell apart. And when they talk about the Golden Age in Andalusia and the like, you know, they can have peace in a way, but it's the peace of submission. If everybody kind of shows up for work and says, yes, sir, and they pay their jizra, the demi tax and all that, you can kind of have hegemony and some things will show up. But there are books written like What Went Wrong, you know, so like 600, 700 around there, they were, and then it just boom, boom, boom. And you wake up today and it's just, they just played out the string. Yeah. Yep.
What evidence remains from North Africa and the transformation that went on there, say from 300 to 900 AD?
You know, by the way, the pyramids, they didn't build them. You know, that's the big tourist thing in Egypt. Like, yeah, you guys didn't build these. But one of the real heartaches is that a lot of the early church stuff and even the letters to the churches in Revelation, all in Turkey, and, you know, Chalcedon and Alexandria and so forth, just incredibly rich stuff there. But they kind of like, except for the tourist trade, they kind of like to say, you know, year one is when we took over. And by the way, it's not a religion of peace. I mean, they came through 100 years after Muhammad's birth, death. They went 1,000 miles east to India, 1,000 miles west to Iberia, 500 miles north up toward the Balkans, and 500 south the Upper Nile. And they just came in, and sometimes they appropriated something. They would just say, the church in Istanbul, that's our mosque, you know. And they tore by, I don't know if that's exactly what you're asking, but you see traces of where the anchorite fathers were and bits and pieces, but it's these are ruins.
You talked about the mess is kind of evidence of human flourishing and stuff like that, that we have kind of the crazy
right.
And
right,
stuff.
Right.
Can it ever go too far? So I'm thinking about Facebook, right? And everybody having a megaphone at this point. And now since everyone's got a megaphone, it seems like there's nothing, like reason has ceased to hold sway.
Oh, no, it's insanity. And by the way, but thank God now we can do our preachments. In other words, things are insane, decadent, pathetic. I mean, we strengthen Islam every time I think Lena Dunham goes on TV or something like that. It's just there's such sorriness and madness and so forth. But on the other hand, we can have Franklin Graham come on TV, or we can have Dr. Moeller or you guys. And so game on. And one of the wonderful things is Romans 2:14 and 17 says that the Gentile who has not the law, the Torah, has it written on his heart with his conscience accusing and excusing. So there is a sense of just sensibility that we can play on here and the gospel. I think the answer for us is like awakening. I mean, it's just Whitfield again, you know, 57-58 prayer revival. That's the hope of America getting it together. But still, we're a place where a Whitfield can rent a stadium and do that. You can't do that in Egypt. So that's our hope. I don't know. Yeah, okay.
I lived in Kuwait for a year. Mid-90s. And I remember it being about 4 or 5 years after Desert Storm.
Yeah.
And a lot of the young people, preteens, early teens, were starting to dress and look in American fashion.
Right, right.
We fast forward to the first part of the 21st century, we see women in the Kuwaiti parliament for the first time.
Yeah, yeah.
So kind of going back to the same question on Facebook, do you see any cultural opportunities for us to break the ground a little bit to make the gospel out?
Yeah. I mean, just a couple of quick things. When I took a course called War College in the Army, one of the guys said the most dangerous thing in the developing world is a Sears catalog. That, you know, it's not like a fancy weapon, but once they see this stuff, so there's that kind of allure. There's a huge embarrassment, humiliation. So some of the guys who are doing the worst stuff are some of the richest and most privileged because it's an affront. But the nations are very, very different. I mean, Indonesia is very syncretistic, and it's kind of, except in Aceh province, is a very laid-back sort of thing. Saudi Arabia, fierce. You know, Iran, pockets of Western. There's a great revival, actually, in northern Iran based out of actually London. They have a lot of stuff coming in there. So you'd almost have to go country by country by country. But what happens sometimes is you have the Arab Spring, you have a little bit of that, hey, we're going to kind of do democracy, and then it goes badly, you know, and they kind of snap back. So long term, it's hard to bet on that horse, I think. Look, Henry, I'll say this. I did, when I was editing SBC Life, I interviewed Henry Blackaby, and well, they had prayer leaders, Henry Blackaby, Doug Betts, Manette Drumright, for the different agencies. And it was like 1993, and the Iron Curtain had just been collapsing. And Henry Blackaby said, before we started, he said, there have been two totalitarian foes of the free spread of Christianity on earth, totalitarian communism and totalitarian Islam. And he said, one down, one to go. And I believe, this Kurdish guy I work with, he's about to talk himself out of Islam right now. He says ISIS is not extreme. ISIS is Islam. He says that's what came up into here and made this area Islamic in the 700s. He said, this fringe stuff, are you kidding me? But one other little thing I would say is, one of the problems with Islam is when you have this the extreme, well, those are just a small part. Well, look, I mean, a small part of Baptist witness, you know, but doesn't mean witnessing is not part of the Baptist core. I think these guys are really getting after it. But the problem is all the other guys roll over. You know, I heard Bridget Gabriel the other night. She's an Islamic convert, kind of with Ayan Hirsi Ali and others. And she said, 90% of the Muslims are happy cab drivers and good neighbors and all that. She says they're irrelevant because when the others do their thing, they get out of the way, either through fear or just self-doubt or just disinterest or whatever, uninterest. So I just think as long as that's the book, it may bob and weave a bit, but I think it's going to have to be a worldwide forsaking. But boy, God bless you. By the way, my son was in the Iraq War twice, and so he would dispatch back, and he works with Muslims, and he loves them. And we can love these guys, but boy, getting them out of bondage is such a dream. Ken, I don't know. He's kind of,
I think that's all the time we have, but let's thank Dr. Coppinger.
Thanks. Appreciate it.